Howdy, I'm Zoe, reader, writer, friend, and you're listening to Broken Spine Social Club, a literary podcast for readers of words. Each week, I sit down with one of my buds to chat about their favorite book. From high modernism to high fantasy, we cover it all, getting to the heart of what makes good writing great or okay writing high impact. So without further ado, welcome to Broken Spine Social Club. Your membership is approved. Howdy, and welcome to another episode of Broken Spine Social Club. I am your host, Zoe Yawn, reader, writer, friend. And this week, we are talking about a subject I'm normally not very friendly towards. But I suppose that's the beauty of reading, right? We are able to come into contact with concepts and characters and aspects of our world that maybe, on a day-to-day level, leave us a little bit fearful, a little bit anxious, a little bit creeped out. That was certainly the case for me when I began to do a little bit of preliminary research into today's pick, Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. However, I'm not going to go into it now. We will get into it on the pod when I sit down to talk about this really brilliant, really interesting science fiction book with my buddy Ross. Without further ado, I'm going to leave you to it. But what I will say is that if you are not a fan of creepy crawlies, maybe you will be after this podcast. Happy listening. Tell me about the trebuchet competition.
This weekend, I partook in Brooklyn's best and only trebuchet competition. We competed as the Oppenhurlers.
Excellent.
So we depicted what would a siege scientist look like, you know?
And what did a siege scientist look like?
We were dressed in full, like, I was in my full Cillian Murphy mode, where my hat, the full suit, like a three-piece suit almost thing, and then also chainmail. So it was good. And then we did like a launch sequence every time that we set off the trebuchet. And every time we launched the trebuchet, we like get onto our knees and say, oh no, what have we done? So it was good fun.
And like, was the competition based on how far the projectile went? Or was it just like whoever had the best vibe?
It was three categories. There was historical accuracy, furthest distance thrown, and handsomeness. The handsomeness of trebuchet.
Trebuchet.
We were competing, and ensemble, so the whole thing. So we were competing pretty much fully for the handsome award. That's what we were going for.
Excellent. That's always the strategy I aim for in all competitions, personal and professional.
Handsome all the way.
Handsome all the way.
But yeah.
Well, Ross, first of all, thank you so much for joining me this evening / late afternoon for this episode of Broken Spine Social Club. I'm very excited. And before we kind of get into the story, I like to ask all my guests, do you remember the first time we met?
I was trying to think of the first time we met. I can remember a couple of the pubs around the first time, but not the exact first time.
Probably in the Snug at Blackbird, which is a very specific place to mention, but like that kind of feels like maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I remember like maybe the second or third time I met you, which was in the No Name Bar.
I don't remember that at all.
I was after going on my first date with May.
No way. No, surely not. We definitely met a few times before then.
A few times, but I think, and it was like maybe a few days beforehand I'd been on my date. I remember how excited you were. So yeah.
That tracks. I would be excited. And in fairness, I still am excited about your relationship with May. But yeah, I suppose we mostly met because you have known my husband Morris since you were 14, younger? 14? Probably 14.
13, yeah.
Damn. That's and over the course of your long friendship, you've done a lot of projects together. A band, how would you classify Wilson?
Pseudo rap group, experimental, social experiment. I always like to tell people with Wilson is it was a band that was so bad that it became a comedy group. which is how I think of it anyway.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would say maybe the Irish lonely island that the world wasn't quite ready for.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're still ready for it.
No, but give us 10 years, then Wilson's going to be back in a big way.
Big, big way. Excellent. Delighted to hear it. Very cool. And in the years since I have known you, you've done a lot of really cool shit. You have become a lecturer
at a leading Irish institution. You have also moved to my neck of the woods, not really, but kind of, the United States of America.
Yeah. A year and a half now in New York. It's been good. I'm enjoying the American experiment so far.
You and May have an apartment that's very much so Dublin-centric. It was so exciting to see. And it's nice to know that you're bringing, you know, that Dublin quality to... What park do you live near? Prospect Park is the big one. We'll say that one. No, there's a little one. Oh, I was gonna keep the smaller one on the DL. I can cut it out. That way people don't know your exact address.
You can cut it out.
In case there are any big sci-fi fans who vehemently disagree with what we're about to talk about.
Yeah.
I'll bleep it. Yeah, I'm very into bleeping. I recorded with a friend who... Oh, I can bleep all this too, so I can just tell you the full story. This is great. I recorded with a friend who at one point Morris and I were trying to hook up with, and it really didn't work out. Yes. And I was like, don't worry, I'll cut this. And she's like, you can bleep it. And I was like, great. So I can just do the exact same thing here. Amazing technology. Tell me about your reading history. What do you normally read? Have you always been a big reader? Do you like to read? Do you hate to read?
I used to be very much an avid reader when I was a kid. I think most kids are, or a lot of kids are avid readers. I definitely then tapered off. I remember I did this big readathon in school. And we had to commit to reading so many books. And I think I only read my brother read 20 books.
Oh my God. Go Lachlan. Weeks. Embarrassing us. I'm going to bleep that.
Yeah.
I'm going to bleep that pathetic number.
It was pretty poor. And then, you know, my record's only gone downhill since. But no, this is the kind of guest you want on your podcast. No, I listen to, so then the real thing is I'm quite lazy. So I usually read a few books and then I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Is what I do. And in terms of what I read and what I listen to, I kind of like to balance it out. I usually have either one or two books going at the same time. Usually I like to balance it out with fiction and now more regularly it's science fiction, mm-hmm. along with either historical fiction or historical nonfiction, or even a kind of journalism stuff. John Ronson's really my vibe. I've gone through all of his
work. What does he write about? I've never heard of him.
He did The Men Who Stare at Goats. He did, The Men Who Stare at Goats is a big one. I'm trying to think of the other ones, what their names were, but it's a lot of, I think Morris describes him as the poor man's, which I'm sure he won't be happy to hear, but one of my favorite authors.
You know what? Yeah. I'll bleep that. Don't worry.
Yeah.
The audiobook thing is really interesting to me because it's not something that I normally mess with. Although, my audiobook, it's probably podcasts. When I'm walking, I'm listening to a podcast. But I do like that idea of juggling the different types of reading, because I find it really difficult to read more than one book at a time. And the only way I can do it is if I'm reading a couple of things that are drastically different. So yeah, a nonfiction, a memoir, something science-y with a novel. But I couldn't read I can even kind of do maybe a literary fiction and a science fiction, or a literary fiction and a fantasy. But I couldn't do two literary mm-hmm. fictions or two science fictions. I'd get very confused. I'm not a very smart girl.
I wouldn't say that, but I think it helps you to digest it better, right? This book we're going to talk about today. I've read all of the author's books, and each time I finish it, I'm like, I don't want to rush in and read another one of his books or another sci-fi series after, because it's just gonna, I want to keep it on my palate or something. So it's usually at that point I might jump to a completely different book, a historical piece, or I might complement it with a more kind of just a science book, mm-hmm. Bill Bryson or something afterwards. Mm-hmm. But just to go back on the audiobooks for a second, what I love about audiobooks is I like that I can then relate something else to it. So I love walking down the same street, I listen to a book, and then if I walk down it again, I remember exactly where I was when I listened to it. I remember the plot points, how I was feeling at the time, or even I listen to a lot of audiobooks while I'm doing either just kind of design work or other work, and say if I'm sewing or anything, I can remember where I was the last time I sewed in a certain book. I find it's really cool as a way of, just for myself anyway, I can just revisit these stories when I just do mundane activities.
That's really beautiful. I have that feeling when I generally read books, I remember when I first read this, I remember the point of life I was at. But to have that very immediate, I don't know the word I'm looking for, almost tactile memory response to something. It's like listening to a song. You know, like I have that same kind of feeling when I listen to certain songs. Like, I remember walking along the canal and I remember exactly what was going on. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about, actually, which is living in a more tactile world. And I think the combination of, because when I read, I'm reading on page, I'm very taken out of my surroundings. Probably not dissimilar to when people are, I don't know, playing video games or watching TV. But yeah, I want to start living in a world where I use my hands more when I'm out in the physical world more. So to have that kind of shared dual experience is really interesting. What a good way of looking at it. Thank you, Ross.
Of course.
It leads me, kind of, not really, to what we're going to talk about today a little bit, which is, this is the first science fiction book I've had on the pod. So I'm really excited because I like science fiction quite a bit. I don't read a lot of science fiction, but I think about science fiction a lot. I watch a lot of science fiction film. And when you suggested this book, I looked it up and I immediately thought of a science fiction book that I really like called Childhood's End. And I was going to recommend it to you on this podcast, but instead I'll say, hold your horses, because my cousin Ben is coming on in 2 weeks to talk about that book, which is his favorite. So yeah, interesting. But the book you've chosen today is Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. And I'm going to give a very little bit about it. It's a big, sprawling science fiction book. Adrian Tchaikovsky is kind of an interesting guy. I know that you have listened to some interviews with him, so you probably know a little bit more about him than I do. He's a British man born in Lancashire. Is that how you say it? Lancashire?
Is it an I or an A? I think you're right. Yeah, Lincolnshire.
Lincolnshire? Yeah. Yeah, something like that. He studied zoology and psychology at the University of Reading, and then he became a legal executive until he transitioned into his career as a full-time writer in 2018, which he is still currently doing. He is a prolific writer of genre, science fiction, and fantasy. And I don't know if you knew this, but what brought him into the writing field was his love of tabletop role-playing games, RPGs.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly, which you have a particular interest in as a writer of RPGs and a player of RPGs as well.
I do indeed. In fact, one of the stories I want to tell is about the first Adrian Tchaikovsky book I read, which then inspired me to write my first RPG game, which I wrote with Maris.
Oh yeah. I didn't know that that's where the idea came from, was reading one of his books. Which book was it?
It was this book called A Cage of Souls, If I can go on a tangent and we can
insert
this wherever, I don't know if it works, but I'd been listening to audiobooks for a while. They were a good thing to do when I was working on some sort of, as you were saying, a very tactile project or working on something. I used to do a lot of model making, and I think I got some 2-for-1 deal on Audible, and there was this weird book called Cage of Souls by an author I'd never heard of. So I just picked it up on a whim, and it was kind of like Heart of Darkness, but set at the end of the world. And what I discovered is this kind of genre called the Dying Earth genre, which are these kind of pulp fantasy books, from the 80s and 70s and such. But I remember listening to this book while I was working on a sewing project. And yeah, it was just describing the brutality of this prison or whatever, this prison camp. And I felt so kind of passively drawn in. And I remember just there was this moment where a very Alec Guinness, this kind of wise man, came to town maybe halfway through the book, came to the prison, and he just said something like, I don't know, we spoil everything, don't we? And I realized it was this really weird effect where I'd become so conditioned by the book, and I started to think like all the prisoners or something. And I remember just stopping in my tracks when I was sewing and just what the hell was that? And it really affected me in a way a book hadn't in so long. I'd become so engrossed that I started to think the protagonists and all the other actors in the book without thinking about it. And then it took for someone in the book to interrupt me, and I was just so impressed by this author that I had to look up what kind of other books he did. And yeah, so it was that book itself and this whole Dying Earth genre which then inspired my first RPG game that I wrote with Mars.
That is wild because that really is very full circle. I'd say we're in kind of like a second coming of RPG-dom, like sparked on by Stranger Things and all of these, you know, it's made it kind of normal, like kids coming out of the basement, you know, people can play RPGs now. But I think Adrian Tchaikovsky definitely grew up in the era where it was like, the 80s were scary for RPGs. It properly, people were like, no, this is satanic. Like it's hurting our kids. It's hurting our society. Yeah. And I think he was very much so of that era, like original D&D, bet into it. And he said he had always loved playing these games. And I think he was in college and he was like game mastering a game called Bug World or Bugland. Which I think was about world where bugs lived and ruled and all this kind of stuff, or had people had bugly powers. And at the same time, he discovered the Dragonlance books, which had been written for Dungeons and Dragons by a husband and wife duo who loved the game. And so he kind of realized like, oh, I can take the skill set here of games mastering and game writing and move it into kind of formal prose writing. And kind of what he has said about that is this idea of setting that, particularly for like fantasy and science fiction, what you're creating is more so than like a plot, kind of what you were just saying is a world. He has a really, really good quote. He says that RPGs allow him to create, quote, a world that extends beyond the boundaries of the page rather than containing those elements needed by the immediate plot. It allows characters to explore, create, destroy, etc. Quote, the world you build needs to be rugged and expansive enough to withstand all the random meanderings and opportunistic vandalism they'll unleash upon it. So he's very driven to like world building, which is a genre thing, but I think it's interesting that that comes from an RPG background.
I mean, that seems to be like a big part of all his books, is this like world building aspect. And it's just, it'd been a long time since I've found any book to be so engrossing. And then I looked about the next book to read in his series was, and it went from fantasy to sci-fi, and went to Children of Time.
And that leads us very nicely onto, I guess, giving a good background into the book we're talking about today, Children of Time. Hugely popular book for this author, Adrian Tchaikovsky. It won him an Arthur C. Clarke Award in 2016, which is like a biggie in the sci-fi world. But going back to what you were saying about the dying earth genre, clearly something Tchaikovsky thinks a lot about, because setting up a little bit of background for our discussion today for people who have not read this book, and just a reminder that this is not a spoiler-free podcast. We're talking in depth about books. So, you know, essentially, this is a science fiction book about a kind of dualistic end of humanity. There's an end to human civilization, and then there's a second end to human civilization, kind of brought on by the first end. So the book starts with Dr. Avrata Kern, who is setting up a terraformed planet somewhere in deep, deep space, far from Earth. It's an experimental planet whereby she and her team are going to launch a barrel of monkeys to this planet and infect them with a nanovirus that will make them super smart and evolve intelligently very, very quickly so they can kind of see what kind of society they build. As she is about to launch this project, civil war breaks out on Earth, destroying nearly everyone, including all currently orbiting space stations, terraform projects, exploration projects. And as the result of that, Dr. Avrata Kern, who survives, goes into kind of like a deep sleep pod, gets her monkeys to this planet and is just gonna wait until they've evolved enough to like accept her as their god. And, you know, she can come back down to this earth and live out the rest of her days. And then it picks up 2,000 years later with a second batch of humans who are the last bastion of humanity, kind of as we know it. They're aboard the Gilgamesh, a spaceship that is looking for these now quote-unquote ancient terraformed planets. In the 2,000 years since the civil war has broken out, humanity has risen from the ashes, but then the ashes suffocated them. Earth is poisoned. There's no more Earth. It's done for. So this is kind of the last outpost of humanity trying to find a place to plant roots, so to speak. And they stumble upon Dr. Avrata Kern / Eliza, her kind of AI alter ego. She's been in this hypersleep for so long that she's now like hyperfused with this thing. And they discover that Dr. Evrona Kern's monkeys did not make it to this planet. Ross, what made it to this planet instead and was infected with the nanovirus?
Spiders.
Spiders! Icky.
I will say, before I recommended this book, I did not know that you were averse to spiders and did not like spiders. I discovered that after the fact.
I've always needed the man in my life to kill the spider. Like, I can't do it. And let that be a warning to anyone who's listening to this podcast that doesn't like spiders. You might like them after you read this book, though. So what drew you to this, or why was this your pick out of all of the books? Because it sounds like you read a lot of, and you read a lot of Adrian Tchaikovsky. So why this one?
Yeah, I think you asked me beforehand to think about like where I was when I read this book. And that actually reminded me of, like, I guess why I liked it so much. So I started reading this, I think, just when COVID was kicking off and everything was like so scary and so weird. And we were just like so boxed in Dublin, you know, the restrictions and stuff. And you couldn't, you know, leave your 5 kilometer distance and all this stuff. And this book was just like, for me, pure escapism. There's escapism where that takes you out of a current scenario, but this is like the next level where it took me, you know, out of my room, out of my street, into space, across time, across species. I just thought it was just so cool in terms of like the sci-fi elements of it and the story and the time span and the scale of it. It was just so cool and interesting. But then even just like the messaging and stuff, just this whole, the empathy of the book, it really changed how I started to perceive things a lot more, or maybe like enhanced how I was. Like, it really made me think a lot more from different perspectives. You know, obviously this book is all about thinking about like from a completely different mindset, like alien mindset, like a spider's mindset. But really what the book is teaching you about is like how different people think, perceive, and just how to empathize and sympathize with others.
That's number one, beautiful. Number two, very true. What's interesting about that reading is when you say the scale of the book, it cuts between a couple of different points of view, timelines. Chapter by chapter, you have the humans aboard the Gilgamesh, who over the course of this 600-page book, I think they're also in space for 2,000 years. So in the end, is it like you've got, like, start to finish, this book covers 4,000 years, which is massive. And the way Tchaikovsky kind of navigates that is he keeps putting his humans aboard the Gilgamesh back into hypersleep. And they wake up periodically when different things are happening aboard this ship, which we can come back to. And the way he addresses it on Spider Planet is, or Kern's World, I suppose, as it's referred to in the book, is generationally. So these spiders, you see their society evolve over the course of 4,000 years with this nanovirus. And what's really interesting is what you were talking about, this idea of empathy. They become hyper intelligent, but they are not hyper intelligent like, you know, talking dog in a cartoon, hyper intelligent. They evolve as per spiders probably would evolve if they had the capacity to form a kind of intelligent society. And everything about their society reflects their strengths as a species. So how they conduct warfare, how they conduct spy operations, gender dynamics, which is a really interesting point in spider society. They form their own little internet almost, but it's not mechanical. It's not electrical. It's like based on pheromones, and they use ants to create kind of mass computing technology. And it's just really fascinating, the world that he's created that's very in line with their natural functioning as a species.
I can only imagine that. I'd say it was like a head melt to write the book, but also like so fun to see, like, you know, what would be the next logical step for everything, or even this, the whole idea of like this whole communication thing or this thought process thing. There's a point like towards the end of the book where they talk about the prisoner's dilemma, where, you know, this whole thing about if two people are trapped in a room and they can either, you know, I forget how you describe her properly, but they can't communicate like, with one another, so they can either vote to.
Yeah, it's you have two prisoners and they're in two separate rooms. They don't have any way of communicating is essentially what it comes down to, is they can't communicate to each other what they're going to say. So you have to judge essentially, like, your option is like be empathetic or.
And the book, how obviously it's fictional, but the whole idea that, like, if you were to extrapolate what a spider is, like, I had the web as a sensory organ, and this idea of the spiders communicate through movement, and they understand the world through movement, through vibrations. And that in the book, they say, like, you know, this idea that to be in a scenario where you can't understand someone, that's unacceptable. You know, it's not like a dilemma to solve. It's like a Gordian knot to break through. And that's where it's so beautiful, I find, this book, is that, like, it, you know, it weaves these, like, you know, super complex, whatever, sci-fi things, tropes and plot lines, but then creates, like, on top of this, like, really fantastical thing, just like a very clear message.
Definitely. You know? I think what's also really nice about that message is that is the fear of coming into contact with, like, a true extraterrestrial alien species, right? Like, we don't even know. The one that I always come back to is Annihilation. Did you see that movie? The Alex Garland had Natalie Portman. It's also a series of books, but I haven't read them. It's this idea that, like, you know, aliens, they might not be tall gray creatures who are humanoid in shape. It could be a scent, an experience, like something that we as humans can't even comprehend. How do you communicate with something that you have no concept of how they communicate? But I think that message of empathy, because, just again, to give a little bit of overview, the book is essentially about the Gilgamesh trying to find a place to land. And they come upon Kern's world. They find out the spiders are there. Kern is like, absolutely fucking not. You're not landing here. This is my experiment. Piss off. There are some more worlds that way. And the rest of the book is kind of what's going on the Gilgamesh during these 4,000 years, which is societies evolve. There's mutiny. There's civil war. Like, in any kind of society, just on a little ship or a big ship, but, you know, scale. In the end, they have no choice but to come back to Kern's world. It's the only place that they can go. Their ship is falling apart. And in the end, they communicate with the spiders and they form a new kind of way of living alongside that builds on one another's strengths. And what's beautiful about that to me is that actually the spiders are not aliens. They're here on Earth. Like, you know, it's this idea that we don't have that ability to communicate with hyper-intelligent spiders as such, but that these two things come from the same original place. And I don't know what to do with that, but just, I think that's a nice aspect of it as well, is that there's, you know, radical empathy, but then there's radical empathy for creatures, beings that you already know, spiders. Would I practice that radical empathy with spiders? No. But it's a good thing that I'm not on this planet then. I would smush.
You know what? I did see some ants today running around my apartment. I keep a clean apartment, but I did see some ants, and I did stop for a second. It's like, I don't want to smush. After rereading this book, to a fault, I'm not a animal smusher, a bug smusher. You know, there are some scenarios I think where you gotta smush a bug, but I'm really not. And then whenever I go back to any of these books, I really become not a smusher.
That's nice. Do you scoop or do you leave alone? Like,
I scoop. I'm a scooper. Nice. Bring to a window, release it into the world. It's someone else's problem now.
Excellent.
To a fault, sometimes you cannot be operating like this in the world, which was like humanity taught in this book, you know. When eventually humanity do find out about, like, oh, this world is populated by spiders, and no point do they say, let's try to work this out. Or they obviously have no idea that they're sentient beings, but they think, oh, well, this is a pest. This is something to wipe out. We know these from old Earth. So let's burn the planet down until we get rid of them, and basically just like repeat the mistakes of their ancestors, you know, and our ancestors. Yeah. And like, it's just like this kind of tragic irony that, like, you know, the humans are going there with this idea just to blast and burn everything. And then the spider's last ditch plan is this, like, almost, it sounds trite when you say it, but like weaponized empathy essentially is the deus ex machina, you know?
It is. It's really sweet. And there are a couple of lines at the end where they first establish true communication with Kern, Dr. Avrana Kern, who, as we kind of mentioned earlier, is now this like half computerized, half like at one point, like at the end, she ends up becoming like dirt, like an in ant consciousness is how she communicates, like her, like crazy shit happens with her, which we can get into later if we want to. I don't know. But either way, that is the first human-esque, I suppose, being that the spiders are able to communicate with. And she also practices this kind of radical empathy because for the past 4,000 years have thought that these spiders are apes. And when she finds out they are, in fact, spiders, she's kind of disgusted. But then she there's this moment where essentially she lets them figure out what they're going to do with these rapidly approaching humans. She's kind of telling them, like, destroy. It's not going to be good. I come from this place. I know what they're like. Destroy them. Get rid of them. Like, kill them. And the spider's like, no, we're gonna try to work with them. And that she, like, kind of just lets them do their thing is very sweet to me. I really, really love that. Something that I want to touch on is what you were talking a little bit about there. This idea of repeating the old Earth's mistakes. One of the things that I think is so complicated about this book is this idea of progress. And Adrian Tchaikovsky has said in an interview that I'll link below in the show notes, that one of the problems with fantasy as a genre is that you kind of exist in this loop, which is, you know, the hero's journey. You know, person is called upon to do this. They get their band together. They learn. They get defeated. They get back up on their feet. They defeat evil and they come home. And there's this kind of very circular journey that you can really only go on. Whereas he says what he likes about science fiction is you have this time's arrow component, which is you take a concept and you release the arrow and who knows where it goes. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at this book, because there's a lot of complications about old versus new and what progress means. So the humanity that we're dealing with aboard the Gilgamesh, historian, I guess is the best way to call him, Holsten Mason, who's kind of the protagonist. Issa Lane, who's the chief engineer. Gwen? I'm not quite sure how to pronounce the chief commander's name. This key crew aboard the Gilgamesh, they are later in humanity's evolution, but they're behind Dr. Avrana Kern's civilization. And they're constantly, they call it the old empire, which we can almost think about as not our empire, but they're constantly like looking for old empire tech or trying to figure out the way the old empire did it, because the old empire had X, Y, and Z, and they're like building towards this in reverse. Whereas our current human civilization, I think we have this view of progress as being so linear, you know, like ancient Romans built aqueducts, we're going to build pipes and piping. We're constantly building and progressing and doing better and better. And I don't know, I don't know quite what I have to say about that, but was that something that came up for you? Did you think about that at all?
Definitely on this re-listen I did, Holsten Mason mentions it a few times, this idea of like, what could we have become if we'd not been reliant on the past? And like, you constantly see it, like, obviously on Kern's world, it's a fresh start and they get to do everything from scratch, essentially. But the humans, it's constantly, you know, they are aspiring to take the best of what came from the past, but also like, it's everything's just kind of like a patchwork and you're just having to deal with the repercussions of what came before you. So in the book, there's this old empire which destroys itself and then it causes this ice age. And that's essentially what this new civilization, Mason civilization, comes from. They live in this ice age and they're trying to learn about the old empire, which at this point is ancient history. And eventually when, you know, the ice melts, they start discovering all the horrible weaponry they developed. And when they go into space, they discover all these like terrible viruses they release into space. I just feel like they're dogged by the past, I suppose. Whereas like on the other side of the story, the narrative is like the spiders, everything's a fresh start. And it's so combative on the human side. Whereas on the spider side, even when they come into conflict, it's more like, how can we incorporate this rather than battle it or stamp over it?
Yes, that's very true. Like everything's a learning opportunity for them. And with the spiders, they have this, they call it understanding, capital U, understanding in the book, which is a sort of genetic code that allows the spiders to actively integrate the memories of the past. So it becomes this, it's a currency, you know, being able to pass along your understandings. And like, it's everything from certain technologies, to memories of battles and wars won. So the way that this spider society integrates the past is also really different from the way that humans do. You see that with Holsten, like his whole job aboard the Gilgamesh is to translate the Imperial Sea, which is the old, old language that Avrana Kern would speak. And it's a constant, like, it might mean this, it might mean this, we're not quite sure. There is a, if I can be really, you know, master's degree in literature annoying about it for 2 seconds, there's one amazing scene that I think plays with this, and it's at the very, very end. The Gilgamesh is about to come into contact for the first time with the Spider Society. At this point, the spiders have built the adorably named Sky Nest, which is their satellite functionality. That was the cutest thing in that whole damn book. Star Nest and Sky Nest. I was like, oh, you little
Star baby. Nest and Sky Nest. They're little balloon cities. Oh yeah, it's very cute.
it's so precious. They are adorable. They've come into contact with the Star Nest or Sky Nest, and now the spiders have made it onto the Gilgamesh, and they are rapidly taking over this ship. And Holsten is desperately trying to get in touch. He can kind of see that there's some communications coming in from this world. He can't quite believe it. He can't quite understand it. And he says, quote, there would be some magic word, some infinitely efficacious command that a truly gifted leader could give, one that would restore the rightful arrow of evolution and allow humanity to triumph over these aberrations. ... Something landed on his back. And something about that, like, concept of, like, desperately, like, clawing forward, and then something literally, like, landing on his back, and the physicality of, like, the back and not being able to see backwards, and this species, like, mm-hmm. all of a sudden catching up and, like, rushing him when he's been perceiving progress as such a forward right. arrow, and it's got to go the right way. And it's like, no, it's coming from the back, buddy. Giant spiders here to kill you. Or befriend
that's,
you.
That's a very cool read. Yeah. But actually, one thing to talk about, I suppose, is you talked about this idea of understanding, which makes then for a really cool literary device, right? Because, like, one of the awesome thing about this book is this, you talked about this, like, arrow, this movement, and this kind of the book follows the same structure because, you know, we're describing from 2 points. We're describing from Kern's world and the humans, and you know they're going to meet, and they meet twice in the book, technically. And there's just this sense of momentum each time that they're, like, moving towards each other, or humanity is moving towards the world and the spiders are moving upward up the evolutionary mm-hmm. chain. And, you know, the question, I suppose, from a narrative or from, like, a structure point of view is, like, how do you write from these two perspectives? Like, so obviously the humans go into hypersleep and they wake up and that's how we interact with them. But the spiders, like, how we keep the protagonists around, I suppose, like, as much as they are protagonists, is this understanding, this genetic lineage, so that we're seeing one spider, like a few spiders. I think it's Bianca. Oh yeah, as well. Yeah. And you are seeing their ancestors each time, but they're inheriting their understandings from what came before. And it's not like they have everything in picture perfect memory, but it's this kind of this loose feeling or association that they know what's come before. And that way it feels like you're following the same character through each time, or a different variation of the same character you've known of read through the book, which is just like, yeah, it's just such a cool device, I find.
Yeah. What is it? Is it Cloud Atlas? Is that the David Mitchell? Oh, did you yeah. see that film with the?
I saw the film. It was nuts.
Yeah, I did too. And I think the kind of core piece of it is it's looking at these two souls over multiple lifetimes.
Yes.
And that's almost how I felt about the spiders, because you start out with Portia and she's just a little thing, you know, hunting spitter spiders, and she gets helped out by Fabian. And then the next spider section you've got Portia again, and now she's got Bianca, and Fabian's there again. And you're seeing it's the same names over lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that idea of the understanding, you're right. It's not like, you know, Portia, who infiltrates the Gilgamesh at the very end, can look back and be like, oh yeah, I remember when I first met Fabian and killed that spitter spider. It's more of this, like, kind of connected concept, a web, if you will, of characters. I know. Big. big.
That's all you need from it.
That's all you need.
I did, like, back when I first read it and then rereading it again, Holston, every time he wakes up from hypersleep and there's like a new fucking tribe or a new coup or something that's happening, I just find it so funny. And just like, you the reader, you're also like playing catch up. You have no idea what's happening. He's hauled from hypersleep by usually just like five or four people with different haircuts or different whatever, and he's brought to a new leader each time, and you have to figure out what's going on.
It really gives me, like, what is it when Sideshow Bob is like stepping on all those rakes, like he just can't get a break, like, yeah. Boom, boom. I also think that was very funny and fucking stressful. You know, they say in like writing school and writing classes, like, start the story where the action is, like, we don't need a bunch of background. And Jesus, does Adrian Tchaikovsky do that? You have no idea what's going on either. Like, it's up, you know, you're right there with him. He does say at some point, you know, they're talking about the chief commander Guyen, and he says something about, this isn't a society. This was never supposed to be a society. This was supposed to be a cargo trip where you have the key crew who are essentially just looking for a new world to drop all this cargo. And when you keep people here for so long, like, there's like 2,000 years on this ship. And I think Holston says something like, there's no culture. There's no, you know, what is this? Yeah. And it's true. It's such a creepy way of looking at this project that they've found themselves in aboard this ship for 2,000 years. But it's still like a cargo mission. I don't know, something about that was really like
yeah, you know, it's so weird. And then, like, towards the end, I suppose, like, you start to get more generation of, like, I guess they call it shipborne, where it's people who live their lives in the ship, all they've known is the ship. And then you start to see all these kind of religions, like, rise and fall within the ship. Well, at one point everyone starts worshiping Guyen as like supreme commander and religious deity. And then, like, another generation later, they become like much more practical people who are all about diligence and work and following, not scripture, but following like textbooks and like the books and how the ship works and like stuff. At one point in the shipborne's history, it's like rote learning or something. They know how to make the ship work, but they have no idea why it works. I know it's tighten a screw here, but I don't know why. And then a couple of generations later, the closer they get. When they leave this cultish, like, life behind, it's more, okay, no, we know what this is for. We're learning with a purpose. And that's probably like the most hopeful part of the book, is like, from a humanities perspective, is when they start to like fend for themselves. And that's when, like, I think Lane is in charge then at that point in the book.
I'm not sure if you can draw this parallel necessarily, but there's a lot in it about, it's almost a very spiritual book, because there's a lot about people coming into contact with either their beginning, i.e. their creator, or their end on a species level. Something about, like, the spiders being able to, they view Kern first as the messenger, like, she's just this kind of satellite, and they know it does something, but they're not quite sure what. And eventually they come into contact with her, and she has ostensibly created them by doing this experimental nanovirus shit 4,000 years ago. And at the same time as they're coming into contact with their creator, there are some really very unsettling lines that Holston has about the end of humanity. It's like, if we don't find this planet and if we don't land on this terraformed Earth, everything is gone. And that, what we were talking earlier, I guess, about that scope and that scale, like, it's not just like the mission's over, the book's over. It's like, humanity is done for. It's done for as we know it. Everything we've learned, everything we've achieved, all of our art and culture and, you know, people and laughter, all of this is gone.
Right before this, or where, like, they're about to have contact with the spiders, he's like, the stakes are so high, though. Individual lives are ever the chaff of war. But if ever there was a just cause for the survival of an entire species, of a whole planet's evolutionary history, is now at stake.
Like, that's the scary part to me. And I don't like spiders, but the scariest part of this book is the idea of being out in space. And, like, imagine being the last human. What does that look like? Like, you're so conscious. I don't know. That's such an unsettling concept to me, but I'm really glad that it had a happy end. And that humans continue to thrive.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, if you blip out, that's it. And then, it's so funny then, because, like, you know, this is, they are the last remnants of humanity. Maybe they're not sure, and they've got to get there. So they decide to hire essentially like middle management. somebody who, to lead the rest of humanity. Someone who is he was elected to lead humanity because he has good long-term planning skills. You know, it's like, I don't know, they just made a bureaucrat in charge of the mission. But then, as they said, there's no culture. So all of a sudden this bureaucrat becomes like the king of the ship, and then it becomes the god of the ship. And then he tries to be like, he's like, I'm the only one here with long-term planning, so I need to keep us going. So I'm going to upload myself to the ship. And he's going to become just like a Verona Kern. Mm-hmm. Who's gone nuts at this point?
Yeah, the upload consciousness thing is very strange to like see it right mm-hmm. then and there. There's a good article, again, I'll put it in the show notes below. It's a long interview with Adrian Tchaikovsky, and he's talking about this idea of the left brain and the right brain, and that you can connect them via implant something that those two halves of the brain could talk to each other so quickly and rapidly. And it's like, what then becomes the operating force of consciousness? Is it the actual parts of the brain, or is it the ability of this functioning piece to make the brain communicate? And what he was essentially saying is this idea of Verona Kern is she no longer knows what's human and what's not. I will say it took me a hot minute to get into it. I loved the human pieces. There's a lot about spiders in the first, like, until they start to evolve society. Like, the first couple of, like, spider segments are very heavy on, like, spider ecology, essentially. Biology, maybe is the word I'm looking for. I did read that there was a question posed to the author, you know, why spiders, why bugs? And he was like, oh, I used to have this long answer about, you know, the, you know, insects are a mirror theory, Kafka, the metamorphosis, but he's like, but I've just always liked bugs. Like, I think that's really what it came down to.
Jumping slightly, I guess, like this series of books, there's two more books in this series,
which you have read.
I've read, the last one came out like last summer, which it was the hottest book. I've been waiting for it for years. I remember a good friend, Oscar, predicted it 4 years ago. Well, who, like, because every book now is a certain animal gets elevated. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Oscar predicted bang on the nose exactly what animal is going to be.
I'll bleep them because I'm very into bleeping. It's and then right?
Yes. He read the one and then he guessed.
Ooh, smart guy.
And in terms of this book, I probably would like, what I think about so often is the spiders versus the ants. That probably like occupies a large portion of my brain. It's just like this part, you know, even within this book, you do see other species that have remnants of the virus take hold.
Mm-hmm.
So like they mentioned that there's, I don't know, some fucking species of shrimp in the sea that can do maths, which is another funny part of the book.
Yeah, it's like the
never really mentioned, you know.
No, it's very throwaway. Like there's a moment like very late on where they're like, oh yeah, by the way, we live peacefully with those shrimp, they do really good math.
They do good math. We don't bother them. They don't bother us.
Exactly.
And then they talk about like there's these beetles that kind of exist just by doing nothing, just by like chilling out. Whereas like the spiders have decided to be, I guess we'd call it like a keystone species, like to change their environment.
Mm-hmm.
The beetles have said, no, we're just piecing out of here. We're not going to do anything. And then the ants, the fact that like it's, this book is like presupposing how one could develop intelligence. And in a lot of the ways the spiders follow us, they're kind of anthropomorphized. Like,
yeah, they have a concept of things like mortality, consciousness, individuality to a degree.
Yeah, and I've seen a few critiques that like say they're a bit too much like us, but then the ants are just completely something different. And it's just so fascinating. Like they're just thought of as this, there's an ant and there's ants and they work like off one another. And it's the same way as ants work now. They're part of a collective, part of an empire of ants. Great gorilla song, by the way. But these ants are essentially just like, they're mindless is how it's described in the book. The ants as a, it's almost like this kind of discovery machine and working machine that it's doing things without thinking about why it's doing it. A super colony, I guess they call it in the book. But it's just, it's so cool and so interesting. When I think about the book, when I was rereading the book, I was just so excited to reach that point of the book where it's the final face-off between the ants and the spiders. for me, that's even better than the finale of the book, I think.
I know what you mean. The way that they're kind of portrayed in this book is, it's beyond collectives, it's hive mind. But even beyond hive mind, because there doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be any decision making either. Mm-hmm. It's just like input, information, output, behavior. And that behavior can change based on the input information. And so eventually the spiders use the ants as a sort of like, first as like, you know, a mechanical engineering, and eventually like an internet sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think what you said earlier is really interesting and really on the nose, which is the spiders don't engage in warfare to necessarily like attack or take over resource, although that's maybe like a byproduct of what happens. It's not an expansionary society, I suppose, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. It's more so it's a survivalist society, and when they need to engage in a kind of warfare, they do so. But then how they use the spiders yeah. is, or the ants rather, how they use the ants is really interesting. They learn from them and they take them on, and I don't know. I don't know what it says though, that like, that these are essentially just like mindless colonies that are okay to take over for one species benefit.
Because I was thinking about exactly that today. I was trying to reconcile with that, because humans, like, they are like, they're literally imposing their vision across the stars, and like, it's sci-fi, but it's the same idea. It's this idea of just imposing yourself everywhere, and like mm-hmm. their terraforming worlds, their vision. They created, the whole point of the book is that they're trying to create like a subservient species mm-hmm. for them, these monkeys. And then I was thinking, yeah, then, but the spiders, they're more about kind of problem solving, but then they do kind of dominate the ants in the end. And there's a bit of debate in the book, I think, as well. They're like, they're mindless, doesn't matter. But then I think at the end, and I guess maybe it's a critique that it comes a bit too late, but he does try to resolve it. He says that like, when the ants make their own kind of, essentially this kind of the computer, mm-hmm. when they can run these computations, that's not the spiders doing anything. That's letting the ants be their full selves. They
yeah.
are kind of like discovery, like they're input output machines, and they're discovery machines. And that's essentially when they do create like ant internet and ant computers, that's not them dominating them per se. It's more so just allowing the ants to be what they be and
yeah.
being able to take the outputs.
It's really similar to this overall idea that's in this book about like, what is evolution and what does it allow? What can we allow? What mm-hmm. can we not allow? This quote, Adrian Tchaikovsky is talking about the gender dynamics of the spider world, which is, it's essentially a flip of what we have in human society currently. The males, because they are smaller and because they were not the hunters, are subservient to the female spiders, and they're totally disenfranchised in the society, if not outright killed just for being males, yada yada yada. And this interviewer was asking, you know, is that a deliberate thing, this kind of gender play in spiders society? And he says, quote, "That is a very definite political thing, but it also seemed a logical way that the society would develop. And I appreciate that evolutionary explanations for social phenomena are very fraught to go into. So I'm not necessarily saying people are like this because of the way we evolved. Although, interestingly, one of the reasons it seems to me most fraught is that it is then used as a justification for why it should be perpetuated, which is certainly not something I'm doing, as you can see from the way things go in the book." So even he has these ideas about biology, evolution, and whether or not that can be used as an excuse for the way society functions, which I ultimately he's like, no, absolutely mm-hmm. not. So then it's interesting going back to that ant thing about like, well, certain elements are given mm-hmm. free rein, while others, it's like, no, I'm being very deliberate that I know this is how it would evolve, but I'm not saying that's the right way for things to evolve, particularly with the gender dynamics in the spider world. So I don't know.
Yeah, we've been very complimentary to these spiders, but they've got some pretty messed up gender politics.
Yeah, it's not great.
It was so interesting how that played out and like the justification they had for it. Yeah.
Well, what I will say, and I think we can all agree on this, mm-hmm. is with regards to the spiders, with great power comes great responsibility. Dun, dun, dun.
This is true.
Spider-Man. Marvel. That'll get this podcast the big bucks. That one's me vying for some of that Marvel money. Please sponsor me. Spider-Man is Marvel.
You mention it.
I think that's it. I think they have to pay me if I mention it. But look, I know we're coming down to the town to our time frame. Is there anything else that you want to say about Children of Time, about this book in particular, an understanding you'd like to pass on?
No, I think we touched on it. I think we didn't talk as much about the characters, which is like another critique people said, that it's not really a character-driven book, which is fair. I think it's a fair criticism. Like, it's much, I guess not every, it made me realize not every book has to be per se.
Really quick, which is a big point to be like, you know, kind of hitting home at the fourth quarter, but I think science fiction is a very interesting way to communicate large concepts, humanity, technology, evolution, movement, yada, yada, yada. And so I do find that like a lot of science fiction books, even the greats, even the classics, they're not like even, have you read 1984 by George Orwell?
No, I haven't actually.
Very good. I only read it for the first time last year, but I find a lot of these science fiction like greats and classics, they're not terribly well written books. Like they aren't what I would call like the characters are really well thought out or fleshed out. The emotion is there, but that's almost not why I want to read or consume science fiction content. It's because that these particular brains of writers, directors, screenwriters, whatever, have such an interesting way of thinking about the world, and that this is the best avenue to communicate that.
I totally agree with that. And that makes, yeah, I can think of like a handful of other like sci-fi, even like sci-fi movies and stuff and sci-fi things I've read that, yeah, like it's more so the ideas you're communicating. And if you enjoy a character, that's cool too, along for the ride. Like, and in this book, there are cool ones. Like, I think Dr. Avrana Kern, spoiler, she persists through the next few books. And
she persisted.
She's an amazing character. She's like one of my favorite characters in fiction, I think. Just it's just a fun, egotistical character. And how do you have character development when you are just like an all-knowing AI? But it happens. Yeah. It happens in this book, and it keeps happening.
You know? Ooh, I can't wait to read that. I love that.
Is this a good part then to plug another book?
Yeah, please do. So that's how I like to kind of round all this out, is what else would you recommend? And it doesn't even have to be a book. It can be anything.
What I would say is, like as I said before, like I like to balance out like a sci-fi book then with another book that's non-fiction. And I think what complements this book so well is An Immense World by Ed Yong. I read it last summer after reading the third series in the book, and it worked so well. And it's a book that I've since like gifted to so many people for Christmases and Passovers and all such. I think he's a zoologist perhaps, but the purpose of the book is to perceive or to try think of like how other animals would perceive the world. So it goes through the whole animal kingdom and says, this is their most dominant sense. So if this is how they operate, this must be our best guess is how they perceive the world. And it's just a really, really fantastic book. And again, it's these ones that kind of make you perceive things differently. Not to be like too trite, but like it's something I can bring into my day to day. I can bring it into work. Like where I work as a designer, we're constantly told you are not your user. You can't design for you. And you have to think about others and like try put yourself in their shoes. And then in your day to day life, just like I find these books, obviously these are talking about animals, talking about aliens and all sorts, but it's just like training yourself to think, okay, well, how would someone else perceive this thing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would recommend Ed Yong's An Immense World and Children of Time. If you haven't read it yet, definitely read it.
Excellent. Well, I'll put those both down in the show notes there. But yeah, just to say, very, very beautiful, very true sentiment. That's the beauty of reading. It puts you into a totally empathetic place. Like you're completely in someone else's world, and maybe you've been there before, maybe you haven't, maybe it's totally foreign and different, but regardless, it's a good thing, good practice to practice. So there you go. Ross, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. I definitely would like to continue reading this series, and I'd love to have you back to talk about Children of, what's the second one?
Children of Ruin, I think.
Yeah. That sounds a bit spooky now. Sounds a bit spooky there, Ross.
If you got scared of this one, that one gets really scary.
No, maybe we'll bring it back for a Halloween. An extremely one, not yeah. Halloween book, but you can try it. But yeah. Either way, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate it, and I hope you have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Giant spiders. Thank you so much to Ross for coming on and bringing Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. I have to say, this is a book that has really changed how I view the world. Not drastically. I will never be completely fond of spiders, but I now no longer view them purely as horrible little monsters waiting to attack me in the dead of night. But that's what reading does, folks. It connects us. It brings us closer together. Cross species, I guess. As always, we'll be back here same time, same place next week for more bookish conversations with my buds. In the meantime, if you are a fan of Broken Spine Social Club, please do us a big solid by subscribing and giving us a 5-star review. It really, really helps. And if you just can't get enough bookish content, follow us over on Instagram at BrokenSpineSC. We're always posting cool stuff over there. In the meantime, I hope that you keep reading whatever keeps the pages turning, and we'll see you next week.